So those are some goals for today. And since it's been a few days, let me just remind you of the setup of supervised learning in general. So supervised learning in general talks about taking some data set with pairs X and Y and then fitting some function to those labels Y. We already saw the specific example of linear regression and what f of X would be there. And now we're going to talk about some different ways of doing that fit. Just to remind you, in general, X and Y can have various dimensions. And just to remind you, so far we've seen one supervised learning algorithm in detail, and that's linear regression, and that was on our first tutorial as well. So there's a lot of different algorithms you can use for supervised learning, and a lot of them are a lot simpler or maybe better starting points for a lot of data sets than neural networks would be. So even though we're not going to have time to go into a lot of them in this course, I'm going to just list a few others. And in one of our tutorials towards the end of class, the end of this class, I'm going to kind of have you guys work to explain some of these topics that we don't have time to cover fully in this class. You guys will kind of explore them a little bit in one of the tutorials. So again, just so you see some terms that you may have heard of to know that these can all be used for supervised learning. And specifically today, I'm just going to talk about k-nearest neighbors briefly because it's one that's quite simple and easy to summarize pretty quickly. And then we're going to spend most of this week actually talking about neural networks for supervised learning. So k-nearest neighbors has a really fitting name because you can actually know most of what goes on in this algorithm just from the name. So let me kind of remind you of this expanded notation that we introduced before, where we kind of label how many samples we have as well. Oh, actually here, I'm gonna just talk about a scalar label here, although again, you can easily generalize to higher dimensions. Okay, so for this algorithm, we need to define some notion of distance. So if I'm trying to determine how to describe some data point x with this function, I'm going to start by calculating the distance from this point x to all points in my data set. And then I'm going to base my prediction off which points are closest to that one. Okay, so then we're going to store the k points that are closest to this x based on this distance measure. Just to emphasize, I chose this 2 norm here, but you could, in principle, define other notions of distance for a similar algorithm. So we'll store all of these points as x star and y star, the ones that are closest. And there's going to be k of those for the k nearest neighbors. And one thing I just want to emphasize, because I thought it could be a little confusing that we have all these indices, like I is something we loop over, but just emphasize K is a property of the algorithm, K nearest neighbors. It's not an index that we're looping over. It's something we defined beforehand. So let me just, whenever I put K, kind of underline it just to remind you it's not something we're really changing as we do the calculation. So for step 3, it's going to depend a little bit on whether our labels are continuous or discrete, or in other words, whether we're trying to do classification or regression, as we talked about before. So if I'm trying to classify into different discrete groups, then I'm going to say my function is just the one that's most common out of all of those k nearest neighbors. And if I'm trying to deal with continuous labels and do regression, then I'm going to just take this function from the average. Okay, and this is really the end of the algorithm. So that's as simple as it is. You would just kind of look at the data points you have that are closest to the one that you're trying to model, and you would use information about that in order to determine what the value of your function should be. So,
what does majority member mean?
Just the most common, sorry, like the one that occurs the majority of times in this set.
But couldn't it be possible that all are different, the closest?
Yeah, if they were all different, then you would probably just choose randomly some number from that set. But if you ideally, I mean, you would have a, you would hope if this is a good, it might not always be a good algorithm to use, but if it is, you and K is big enough as well. I mean, if K is only one, there's only, that's actually something people often do is just set K equal to one. And in this case, you just set it equal to whatever the closest neighbor is, then it would, the majority member of a set with just one element would just be that one element. But if say you take K to be very large, there are a lot of cases where, you know, it would be kind of overwhelming which one is most common, and this could work well in some of those cases.
But intuitively, if you increase k size, it means you're also going further away from the point.
Yeah, for sure. So it could also depend on how big your data set is, for sure, right? Like if you only have, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Like it's not, I think that would be something, let me just write this one point because this gets exactly to what you're saying. And then I'll come back to your question. So one word that we started to talk about last lecture is a hyperparameter, which is kind of a parameter of our algorithm that we can adjust. And K here is another hyperparameter. So as you were saying, there can be trade-offs. It sometimes could be, for some cases, it could work well for K to be only one. And in some cases, we might want it to be bigger to average over more. But as we make it bigger, as you said, we're including more points that are further away. This isn't always a good idea. But the idea of kind of averaging, in case some of those data points maybe aren't as good as other ones, to kind of do some averaging can be a good idea. So definitely, I'm not going to tell you, you know, it's best to set K to one value. This is something you would want to try out and probably vary a little bit.
Yeah, it's in my mind that regression case, when you average things, it's intuitive that you're trying to cancel off all the errors and try to converge on something. But when we are doing in discrete case, if you increase K, and so there are, you're going away from your point, there are possibilities that away from the point, things repeat.
And yeah. Yeah,
so
sure.
So if what you are assigning to the value at that point is something which is very far away as compared to something near. That's
very, no, for sure. I think you're right that, you know, if you could imagine a data set where maybe you have some boundary between where the label is one versus the other, if you're getting close to that boundary, you know, if you go too far, yeah, you could be getting things from both classes. You know, like in these kind of cases, you definitely have to be careful of what you do. And I agree, for sure. You could definitely have cases where, if you take K to be huge, it's going to be meaningless because the things you're averaging over aren't representative. Yeah, no, absolutely. You have to think about that for sure. Yeah. And let me just say one more thing, because when we were talking about linear regression, you know, we, for example, we introduced these weights that we would be fitting to within our algorithm. So that's what we would be trying to adjust. Those were kind of parameters of the algorithm that we try to fit. Note that in this algorithm, there are no fitting parameters. Once we define this hyperparameter K, that's all we have to do. It's very simple and straightforward from there. So something I said last time, but I just want to repeat, is that this algorithm is often would even be the starting point or something even simpler than linear regression. And the reason I started with linear regression was just because we wanted to do that for our tutorial. So I kind of wanted to make sure we covered that last time. But this would be, you know, if you had some data set and you wanted to do supervised learning and you kind of wanted to go from easiest to implement to more difficult to implement, you would probably actually start here.
Lauren?
Yeah.
Along Manu's comments, I think these two algorithms are for different regime. Like if we have lots of data, it's better to choose majority, right? If I have less data, it's goes to good to average.
No, no,
this is because something is discrete and not discrete. If you have discrete points, then
yeah,
averaging does not
be
work.
Discrete, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both.
I mean, it's about whether your labels are discrete or continuous,
yeah,
right?
Discrete.
No, but when you average things, it may not lie in those discrete set. That's why you're averaging. Mm-hmm. Only when you have a continuous set of things, only then averaging could lie.
Yeah, think about the case of like the handwritten digits, for example. The idea would be you would look, you would kind of take pixel by pixel a comparison of your input image with some other known ones and see which one by this distance measure seems closest or which few. But you know, if you had this set where, let's say you were doing three nearest neighbors or something, and you said that, okay, the closest ones are 1, 7, and 7. Those are the labels of the three closest points. If I average this, it's not going to make sense, right? I would probably say, okay, I'm going to take the label to be 7 because the three images that are closest are these.
But even if it's both is continuous, in this limit, I think when we have lots of data, the first scenario is better. Like you take the majority of them instead of averaging, right? If you have lots of data for around every point. I don't know. I think in continuous limit, also both.
I mean, but if you have continuous data, you're not likely to have something that repeats, right? Like if you say you're looking at energies, you could have like 4.6, 4.62. And I mean, then you could imagine like it, yeah, you probably do maybe want to take the average in that case, right? Yeah, these are all really good points. And again, it's the way you would choose K, for example. And yeah, whether this is a good idea or not would really depend on your data set. There's lots of data sets where it's not going to work well. Yeah.
This could be like a silly question.
No, no.
I don't understand why we're using the particular distance measure that we are, but
yeah.
It seems to me that that's also a choice you have.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
What would justify using some other metric?
I mean, I guess it would be needing to understand your, if you had some knowledge of your data and you maybe knew what it means to be close in some data set. I mean, I think, the two norm, I think it's going to give you the same answer as the one norm, I believe, in this case. Yeah, it's just a matter, it's whatever's closest by one is the closest from the other. So this is a distance that's all based around subtraction. You could have data sets where that really doesn't tell you anything about something close. We'll actually see some examples later in the class about topological data, data that is representing a system with topological order. And there, this distance measure just is basically meaningless. It doesn't really tell you anything about whether the label is close or not. So this is really how the algorithm is usually presented. They measure this distance here. But yeah, if you maybe had an interesting data set where you know this doesn't work, you could maybe put in some knowledge of that data set and use a different distance. Anything else? Okay, so this is just kind of, I wanted to kind of show you guys that there's lots of different ways you can do supervised learning. But again, a big focus of this class is to explore neural networks. So let's start talking about that now.
So I can ask one more question?
Yeah.
So a hyperparameter is just like a number we can vary, but just going back to that metric example, that's also kind of like a...
Going back to which example? Sorry.
The metric.
Uh-huh. Case. Yeah. That could be a hyperparameter. Yeah.
And we can also think of a
hyperparameter. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. Often, if you just look up this algorithm, they're going to kind of present this, but as just kind of in this way, which is why I didn't really emphasize that that's a hyperparameter too much. But yeah, it absolutely could be. Okay, so let me start by drawing you a feed-forward neural. This is. We're going to be looking at something called a feed-forward neural network. And then we'll kind of explore more sophisticated neural networks as well later on. Okay, and sorry, let me just fix my, erase my underline here because I need to label something. So let me just kind of show you some notation here. A little easier. So my first, I can label these vertical sections as layers. And I'm going to start at zero in this case. So here, this is going to be called layer zero. And the idea here is that my first layer is where I put in my input. Then everything in the middle. Sorry, guys, if this is small, let me try to write a bit bigger. In the middle, we have one or more hidden layers. And then the last layer is called an output layer. And so in the beginning is where I feed in my input. I already know. We've already talked about what input is. So what we would feed in on this left-hand side here is my input x. So x1 up to x dx. Yeah.
This is just one data point.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
We're going to talk about it one data point at a time. In the way we implement, we're actually going to use matrices probably, but I mean, that's just kind of an implementation detail. So let's talk about it one data point at a time. Yeah. And just a little bit more notation here. So each circle, we call these neurons. And the notation can vary a lot depending what reference you look at, but this is the notation I'm going to use. So each layer could have different numbers of neurons. So NL is going to be the number in layer L. Capital L is going to count how many layers I have in total. So for example, here, I'm going to say this has three layers, or I'm going to just say L equals three more specifically, because the biggest value of L is this third layer here. And then I'm going to introduce this new variable A, which is going to help me define the output from any given neuron in this network. So the output from the jth neuron, that's the subscript in layer L. So then let's connect this notation with some other definitions we've already seen. So then the dimension of my first input layer is just going to be dx, the dimension of my input. The number of neurons in the output layer is going to tell me the dimension of my labels. And the output from all the neurons in my input layer is just going to be coming from the components of x. You guys have any questions about this setup so far? We still haven't really talked about exactly what all of this notation means, but for what I've defined so far, are there any questions? Okay, so we've now talked about what a few things mean in this picture, but let's go a little deeper. So let's zoom in on some general neuron in this network, the jth neuron in layer L. What does everything mean here? Well, we can see it's taking on the left, this is what it's taking in, and then on the right is what it's going to output. So we have some lines on the left, some lines on the right. What it's taking in is the output from all of the neurons in the previous layer. So it's taking in all of those previous outputs as input to it. And then it's feeding that in to the next layer. But it's actually feeding the same thing into everything in the next layer. So we're just kind of showing that it goes many different places. So all of those lines on the right are really representing the same information. So, you know, if I was just drawing one neuron, it would be equivalent to just putting one thing on the right. Okay, and now, how do I actually get this input? I mean, I've told you that this neuron takes in this input, but how does it actually calculate its output? Okay, so it's going to apply some linear transformation to this, to everything from the previous layer, but then apply some overall function to it. So let me kind of break this down. And first, let me say everything that's input to this function, we're often going to call z. So this GL, it's called an activation function. It's a nonlinear function, and we're going to apply that to every layer of our network. And in principle, you could choose it to be different for every layer. So the choice of what you put for G is another hyperparameter of your network. Then weights, there's one weight parameter for every single link that connects two neurons in this network. And then there's a bias parameter for every neuron. Now, this is something we need to explore in more detail still, but now is the first time where I can kind of at least vaguely tell you what it means for this network to learn. It really means that it's going to play around in some smart way with different weights and biases to try to represent our data. So these are kind of like our fitting parameters in this model.
Sorry, could you explain again what the activation function is?
I'm going to give you some examples, but it's basically just it's a nonlinear function that takes some input and then gives you an output. But the important thing is that it's nonlinear, so that we're kind of combining some linear transformations and then some nonlinear functions here overall. But I'm going to give you examples of that. Yeah.
So we just have a, you know, affine, it just basically gives us a vector, and then we're like component wise doing a nonlinear thing on this vector. So if I get like, so let's say layer L has like two sites, the vector, and then I'd like do tanh to the first component and the second component.
No. So we do, this is summing over everything from the previous layer, right?
The J is fixed. So it's like the jth component.
Yeah, but we're going to do, this is going to be the same for every layer. So for this layer, I'm going to apply tanh everywhere if it's tanh that you're doing.
Applying it to every, like I have a vector.
Yeah.
And then I apply a nonlinear function to each component of that vector.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Normally, you don't apply nonlinear functions to vectors, so I'm just trying to make sure I understand that word. Yeah, that makes sense, I think.
Yeah, okay, good. Any other questions? Yeah.
Do you have an example of when you would define a different activation function per layer?
Again, this is like another hyperparameter of your network. So it's actually something we'll explore in the tutorial tomorrow. We'll play around with different choices on different layers. Often, you can play around with it on every layer. Something more common that you might see more often is to do something different on all, like something that's the same for all the hidden layers, but maybe different for the output. Because we know a little bit about what format we want the output to be in. So again, that's not saying you always do that, but that's just maybe something you might see a little more often. But you can, in principle, put something different for each of the hidden layers. So hyperparameters are something which, again, this choice of activation function is a hyperparameter. So again, that's something we're usually going to want to explore several different choices and see how it affects the performance for the given data set that we're looking at. And that'll be part of tomorrow's tutorial.
Also, to generalize, means is there a restriction on using the same GL for all the nodes in a layer? Is there a restriction, or it's just a simplification case? Like we could in tomorrow.
That's a good question.
In general case, you could apply different functions on each node also, but make something bad or?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never seen it where people put something different on each node, but I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not seeing a reason why you couldn't. Maybe I can try to think of if, maybe I can try to look and see if there's a reason why people don't usually do that. I guess there's already a lot of parameters in this network. So like maybe that's something you could do. I guess in general, so I'm going to give you an answer. I'm like almost hesitating to do it because I feel like I kind of want to think about it more before I answer. But let me say this with the caveat that I could rethink it and come up with something else tomorrow. But the way we formulated this now, all of these neurons are basically treated the same. So this is kind of introducing some asymmetry in the way we treat these nodes. So there could, these neurons, sorry. So you kind of lose that sense of, I guess, somehow averaging behavior if you do that, but that's not to say you can't do it. Like there's not any mathematical reason why you couldn't try a function that does that. Let me look into it and see if I can come up with like a better justification of why that's usually the same. It's a good point. Anything else?
But maybe we want to vectorize the nonlinear part, right? Because if we vectorize a calculation, it becomes very fast. A nonlinear function are hard to calculate, right? Because matrix multiplication is simple. So element, different element.
You're saying doing something linear here?
The nonlinear part is vectorized, right? Every element behave similarly.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of like, it becomes very faster, right?
Yeah, there could be a speed effect, yeah. Yeah.
That could be.
Yeah, that's one pro for it for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to contrast this with like just normal circuit computation, which is a non-uniform method of computing. Is this doesn't seem to scale with the size of the input. Like the same neural network would work regardless of the input size.
That's
true. You would have to change the number of neurons in your first layer if you had a different input size, right? Like the first layer core, you mean the dimension or the number of data points?
The dimension.
So the DF?
As I change, I'm just confused if at the end of the day you have to define like a family of neural networks.
So.
Or like you would in a circuit model?
No, so actually what we really want is one network for our whole data set. But I haven't really explained to you how we're considering every data point yet, but that's coming for sure. Like right now I'm just kind of trying to explain to you, if I had a network and I was taking an input, what would be my output? And what I would like, and I'm going to be writing this a little bit more concretely, but I would like that all the same weights and biases could be used for every element of my data set. I'm kind of trying to optimize them so that they can approximate anything in my data set pretty well. But again, like that, the way that we do that is coming up still. Does that answer your question?
Even if I just fed in like a subset of my data set, I don't need to have some other smaller neural network to compute that one. I can feed it into the same neural network.
So right now, there's nothing in here that I've shown yet that is taking account of how many samples you have. I'm only and computationally, we would kind of feed this in as a matrix that would have one dimension for the number of samples, but that's really just an implementation detail. So for the theory, everything here is just about the dimension of your data set. So whether I'm looking at, say, two, what were we, in the example that we gave in tutorial, the dimension of x corresponded to the number of spins in my data set. So it would be like one piece of information to every pair of spins that I had. So everything here is just about the kind of the property of the input data, I would say, like not about how many samples yet. But again, that's coming. Any other questions? These are all really good questions. And I defined some notation already, but I postponed a bit of it until I introduced some of this. So let me now just say, I've so far just been talking about components of this A, but I could also think of it as a vector. Just to kind of make it really clear what I mean when I define that. And with this notation, now I can say, that the output from my last layer is going to be what I'm calling f of x for this neural network. That's the function that I'm trying to fit to. So lots of different activation functions are possible. Let me draw a few for you. And I'll just say that in the tutorials and homework assignments that are coming, you're not just restricted to these ones. These are just some common ones. So the first one I'm going to show you is actually one that we're probably going to use the least, but it's kind of pedagogically what it makes sense to start about, talk about first. So the first one that people started off thinking about in these kinds of networks is a perceptron or a step function. So it's, you can basically think of it as am I going to take this neuron to be on or off depending on the input that it gets. So this is something that is kind of nice, and we can kind of think about in this way what it might mean. So for every data point I send in, some subset of neurons will be on, some will be off. It turns out that this is not such a great one to choose a lot of the time. And we'll be able to kind of flesh out why a little bit more, but I'll kind of explain it a bit now. The reason is that we're going to see in coming lectures that when we try to learn the values of parameters, we're going to be taking derivatives of output. So learning is going to be difficult here because of the behavior of this function. It's not really going to give us much information about what we should adjust. So again, you can try this, and it has this nice interpretation factor that you can think of it as on or off, but when we're trying to learn things and adjust parameters from gradients, it's going to turn out that it just isn't as useful as other choices, but you could experiment with it if you want. Another possible choice is a sigmoid. This is kind of a smoothed out version of what I showed you previously. Let me go to the next board just in case you can't see. I can also do a tanh function. Somebody mentioned this one already in discussion. So there's no restrictions on what the range of the output in principle has to be. So this is another option. It kind of has similar features to the one we saw previously. There's another one. That looks like this, kind of a piecewise defined function, which in principle often tends to work well on certain systems that we'll explore tomorrow. Now, we could also consider something similar to this one, but a more smoothed version of it. And this would look something. Supposed to go through zero. Okay. So, you guys have any questions about these choices? Again, I'm not going to tell you any justification why in principle you should choose one or the other, because the strategy I like to show is that tomorrow we'll experiment with a lot of these and kind of explore the performance that we can get.
So it's not typical at least to try and fit an activation function as well. You kind of just want to change the W's and B's.
It's not typical, no. So yeah, and I think we'll see. I'm trying to think if there's, so in principle, one thing you could do The way I've seen it done more commonly is that you would train your W's and B's for each, for whatever hyperparameters that you're choosing. Whatever you're choosing here is a hyperparameter. And you could separately have an external function that's exploring different hyperparameters, of course, too. But we don't tend, no, within our fitting procedure, we're not putting in parameters here. We're fit, these are, anything you adjust here would not be called a fitting parameter, it would be called a hyperparameter. And it's kind of, we separately adjust the parameters, hyperparameters.
Also, this might be a silly question, but like, should we be in the...
Sorry. Sorry, can you start? Because I thought I could listen while I moved the board, but then I couldn't hear you.
For like the exponential linear unit, mm-hmm. do we want it to be smooth at the origin? Is that...
That's kind of the motivation for doing this, is that actually...
E to the z over alpha instead.
E to the z over alpha. You could probably, like, without this alpha, and just put e to the z over alpha.
Or you could just define e to the z and then divide z by alpha in the argument.
Right. Oh, just that.
Like alpha quantity
mm-hmm.
is e to the z divided by alpha and then minus 1.
Without this second case, you mean?
Right.
That you're meaning the derivative is not smooth
yeah.
right now? Or? Yeah, so the derivative being smooth exactly at this point is not really exactly what we're worried about, because it's just so unlikely that you're going to numerically have an input that's exactly at the origin. But it's more about, I guess, smoothing this part over here. But absolutely, you can smooth it in lots of different ways. This is just like what people, when someone specifically says exponential linear unit, this is what they mean. But there's other smoothed versions of this function or something similar to this function. I just like chose this one to show you. But yeah. I'm sure, I don't know why this one, I think there are some studies that having this kind of behavior here, where it's linear here, there have been some studies where they've shown that that's effective. So I think the motivation for that one was to keep this part the same. But again.
Well, why not define it to be like alpha z? It's fine, it doesn't matter.
No, tell me, I just didn't hear your question. Say it again. Why not define?
It's probably fine to just move on, but also, like, I was just wondering, why don't you, instead of just z, why not just make it alpha times z, so it is smooth, but I think it probably doesn't matter.
Here, alpha times z here.
I was talking about the second.
Sorry. Why can't this be alpha times z?
But it's probably not important. So.
Oh, I see. That then...
It would be smooth at the origin, but again, I don't want to get too caught up on something. Like...
Ah, I see. Gotcha. Yeah, that I see what you're saying now, and I agree. That seems to make more sense.
Is alpha typically a small value?
Again, it's something you can explore a lot for your data set. So it's not, it really can depend a lot on the properties of your data that you have and other things that we're going to introduce in our algorithm. So it's, again, something you would probably play around with to see what. It's just like think about the learning rate from the last tutorial. We adjusted it with many orders of magnitude, but the value you would choose could depend a lot on the data set that you have.
Because I was just thinking if alpha is small, then maybe that's why they don't multiply it in the linear section.
Yeah, this is a really good point. And I know that the motivation here was really just to like focus on this part of things and keep this the same as this. But again, like this is, I think you could probably put it here and it would have the same benefits as this one. And maybe it would have this additional benefit that you pointed out. So it's a really good point.
Small is a motivation because if you want to mimic this, you want it to be very small. If you want to mimic this rectified linear thing,
mm-hmm.
and then alpha being small will not give what actually was saying. Maybe
right, then this tail is going to be like this tiny little thing here versus, yeah, and that's not really what you're looking for. Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, so yeah, definitely I've kind of drawn a smoother version of this, right? Like with some values of alpha, it wouldn't really look this smooth as I've shown. Something you guys could try if you want, and you can tell me the results of whether it's actually, maybe Maybe it is better to do what you're saying, and I'm not sure, maybe it's not. But again, it would just be another choice of this activation function, and I don't have the answer of whether it's better or not. We could also consider one where it's like, like to be super general, I could just put a beta here, right? And then you can explore alpha and beta. But again, we also try to like not have too many hyperparameters in general. Okay, so very last thing I'll say, and then I'll leave the rest for tomorrow. That, you know, I've said a few times, or I said at least once, I should say, that you'll notice that on those functions, the range of the output varies depending on which activation function I choose. For the hidden layers, I don't really have any restrictions. But of course, for the output layer, I do. If I know that my labels are between 0 and 1, then some of these are not going to be a very good choice. So just to note that that's one way we can see that it, we are a little more restricted on what activations we functions we might want to use on the output layer. And specifically, there's one kind of different activation function that doesn't really fall in the same category, where I just take a scalar input. And this is specifically for the output layer. So in this case, this is something where rather than applying things element-wise, this operation actually has to be done to the layer as a whole. And I'll just quickly say that the a big motivation to do this is then the outputs from your output layer can be interpreted as probabilities. So in classification problems, we'd often like to be able to think of the output we get as what's the probability that my data is in class 1, the probability it's in class 2, et cetera, to the end. And so doing this kind of transformation, the normalizing transformation that just makes sure we can output things as a we can think of things as probabilities. I had planned to now talk to you just a little bit about how we can teach the network to learn, and introduce you to cost functions and different choices of learning algorithms, but we'll do that next time. So just to emphasize, so far we've kind of seen the setup of these networks, and next time we'll be more devoted to how we can train them and how we can adjust them to model our data set. Do you guys have any questions? Sorry, I went 2 minutes over there. But any questions? Okay, I'll let you guys go. Feel free to, I'll stay for a few minutes. I know you guys are still writing things down, but I want to let those of you that are finished go to lunch. So see you tomorrow.